It's time for our regular segment with the barrister and solicitor with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. It's Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan. Morning, Michael. How are we doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Always good to be here.
Some interesting stories on the agenda today, including damages being awarded and cultural practices of an impacted party being relevant in the determination of the sum.
That's exactly right. This is a sad case. It's a case that involves a young man who was only age 17, who back in March of 2019, just 3 months shy of graduating from high school, was struck and killed by a vehicle. The case involved the young man's parents suing the driver of the vehicle and Toyota Credit Canada, the owner of the vehicle, for compensation. And there are a couple of things to be aware of. First of all, this is a case which predates no-fault insurance in British Columbia. No-fault came in 2021. And I'll speak in a couple of minutes about how this same circumstance would be handled under no-fault insurance now. But prior to no-fault, one of the things to remember, and this has continued, is that you don't get generally compensation for the grieving and loss you suffer, for example, when a loved one dies due to somebody else's negligence. What is available, and I should say the courts have pointed out that there's just no way to do that, right? There's no amount of money that could make up for the loss of a child. But what is available or was available to people prior to no fault and would be available now if there was negligence causing a death not related to a motor vehicle accident would be financial compensation for the financial loss somebody might suffer. And so in some cases, that's readily apparent. Like, let's say you had a single parent of young children who was killed by somebody's negligence driving, at least prior to 2021, when fault mattered. The child could be awarded the loss of financial support they would have received from their parent, right, over their expected lifetime. Or if you had a spouse that was financially dependent on another spouse who was killed, they could receive compensation for the lost income. That, of course, is all we can do for people, right?
Yeah.
Now, the corollary of that is that when a child is killed, usually there's going to be no financial loss. There'll be great emotional suffering and loss, but generally, kids who haven't graduated from high school aren't supporting the family. And so ordinarily, very little would be available. Now, the interesting thing in this case was evidence that was called from an expert. He was a professor of Asian studies. The young man who was killed was from Korea. His family moved here when he was 10. They settled in Nanaimo. And they moved here, I think, to sort of further their only child's education, thinking the system available here was better than the all-consuming, highly competitive model described in the judgment in Korea. And by all accounts, this young man was a very diligent young person. Not only was he doing well in school, he also did all kinds of things to help out the family, including working long hours in the family's restaurant without pay, translating things to English, doing all sorts of helpful things in the family. But the special evidence that was led was evidence of a Korean practice, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, hyodo, H-Y-O-D-O.
Hmm.
And it's described as a duty that traditionally weighs most heavily on the eldest son. This was an only child. And in fact, it was a legal requirement in Korea up until the 1990s. And it imposes an obligation on children to support their parents, including financially. And the theory of it would be reciprocity and repayment for sacrifices a parent made in raising a child, obligations that a child would have to their parent, sort of moral and in fact, legal obligations in Korea. An appreciation for parental sacrifice is one of the principles, and an expectation that parents' wishes around care in their old age would be respected and child would help support their parents. Pretty good values.
Yeah.
And so the evidence here was that this particular young man was very diligent and would likely have supported his parents as a result of that cultural obligation. There were a few interesting elements to that. One was the judge admitted hearsay evidence with respect to things that the young man had said to others before he passed away, finding that the hearsay evidence about statements he made concerning his how seriously he took his obligations to care for his parents were admissible under a principled exception to the hearsay rule that they were necessary, he'd passed away, and likely to be reliable. And so then the judge engaged in an assessment of what was the financial loss that his parents suffered in the context of that special cultural obligation to support his parents financially. And so the judge listened to evidence about, for example, the work the young man did in the family restaurant without pay, the expectation that he would carry on in the family business, what that would mean. Also, interestingly, the judge took into account things that would be like expenses that were foregone, right? Things like, you know, the likely cost of, for example, contributing to a wedding or cultural expectations that the family would, you know, provide financial support to help him purchase a home if he got married.
Yeah.
And so the effort was to sort of figure out what is the financial consequence of this young man's death. And the result of all that was a conclusion that the family, the parents that survived, should be awarded $327,000. And so it's a very interesting example of how those cultural differences played into it, and as well sort of how the legal system and the common law would try to respond when there is that kind of a loss. It's also very interesting to contrast that to what would happen now, after May of 2021, under the ICBC no-fault
system. Okay.
So under that system now, the way it works is that if there is a parent who is at the time of the accident financially dependent on a child, now that's very important because at the time of the accident, the parents weren't financially dependent on the young man. They were going to be, but they weren't then. But nonetheless, if a parent was financially dependent upon a child at the time of an accident, the ICBC no-fault system would now provide between $37,670 and $65,381, a tiny fraction of the actual loss determined by the judge in this case. The no-fault system would also provide $9,949 for funeral expenses, and $4,161, how does that get computed, I'm hard-pressed to say, for grief counseling. That's it. Now, if you have a circumstance like in this case, like if this happened under no fault now, where the parents are not financially dependent at the time of the accident, right? The young man was 3 months from graduating high school.
Yeah.
The parents would be entitled to a lump sum payment of $16,256. That is the precise amount that's been calculated under no fault that could be payable when you have this sort of a circumstance where there's a death, where there's somebody who's not financially supporting the other at the time of the accident. And that, to my mind, is grossly unfair, right? Hmm. It would, under that sort of a bureaucratic scheme that we now have, would pay complete disregard to the actual reality that the judge found existed in this case on this evidence given this particular person, right? You know, there may well be other children who are not likely to be much of a financial help to their parents. Let's be realistic, right? But by treating everyone sort of as a cog, the result of the no-fault system, using the language which I find every time I read it as the most offensive government speak, they call it enhanced accident benefits, right? And so what we have now is you could not sue the driver who was careless and killed the 17-year-old, and instead you would be entitled to the enhanced accident benefit for the funeral cost and where there isn't support for the person at the time of the accident, you'd wind up with funeral costs, grief counseling, and $16,256, which this case, I think, demonstrates would be grossly inadequate to compensate properly for the real loss involved. And so to the extent you find you're paying less for your enhanced accident benefit no-fault insurance, you should bear in mind that if tragedy strikes, like most things in life, you're going to get what you paid for. And that's what's available to you now.
Michael Mulligan from Mulligan Defense Lawyers, legally speaking. We'll take our first break right now and be back in a moment. Back on the air here at CFAX 1070 as we continue legally speaking with Michael Mulligan from Mulligan Defense Lawyers. Michael, back on the air. Where were we?
Well, the next case on the agenda is a decision involving First Nations that were challenging the mineral exploration legislation in British Columbia. And there are a few interesting elements of it, including it's the first case to interpret how the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People Act ought to play into court claims, which is no small matter. And to understand the case, there's a brief explanation required for how somebody would explore for minerals in British Columbia. And that's governed by the Mineral Tenure Act. And the way that works is that somebody who, in the language, is a free miner is entitled to register a mineral claim over unclaimed Crown land. And if they register such a claim, they have some rights to do things like explore for minerals, dig to look for minerals, search for them. But then if minerals are found, before they could be exploited in any commercial way, there'd have to be a separate kind of permit obtained.
Hmm.
Now, the provincial government would consult with First Nations groups at the stage of people applying to like get a permit to set up a mine, but not at the stage where people are, you know, digging with a shovel looking for minerals, right?
Hmm.
After filing one of these mineral claims.
Yes.
And this was a court case where some First Nations were arguing that that legislation was unconstitutional on the basis that it was either interfering with their constitutional rights to land, or that it was unconstitutional because they weren't consulting before permitting people to do things like that kind of exploration, like digging around with a shovel looking for minerals. And then they also made a claim that the legislation was inconsistent with the piece of legislation that BC passed in 2019 called the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People Act.
Yes.
That particular act has a lot of pretty broad things in it, and it attaches to it the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which starts out with the proposition that, you know, Indigenous people are equal to all other people. That should be not at all surprising or controversial. It's hard to imagine we need to confirm that. But then goes on for many, many pages listing various other rights. And so the claim here was, first of all, you know, you didn't follow that. Now, the judge in the case, first of all, found that indeed there's a test to be applied as to whether there is an obligation on the government to consult with First Nations before doing things like, you know, setting up mines or putting in pipelines, this kind of thing. And that test is referred to as the HIDA test. And really, there are three components to it. The first part of it is the province aware of a First Nations asserted claim to a territory? That's basically the whole province. I think it's claimed 150% or something, right? Multiple claims overlap.
Hmm.
That's not usually going to be controversial. Does the province contemplate doing something? And then finally, could the conduct adversely affect or impact an Aboriginal claim or right? That's the test.
Hmm.
And the judge found here that, in fact, what can be done by somebody once they file one of these claims that would allow them to explore looking for whether there could be minerals somewhere, does in fact trigger that duty to consult. And the judge found that because the judge concluded on the evidence that that sort of activity, you know, digging, looking for minerals, for example, could impact areas of significant cultural, spiritual importance, I guess, depending where somebody was digging. And further, there's a right that somebody can assert to financial benefit from minerals within a claimed territory, right?
Hmm.
And so the judge found that, indeed, the way the system's currently working doesn't comply with that requirement as found to exist under that HIDA test. And so the judge, well, the judge declined to find that the legislation was unconstitutional on the basis that the current legislation would allow for consultation, right? A system could be set up to consult with First Nations before somebody would be permitted to start you know, digging with a shovel looking for whatever, right?
Yes.
And so rather than finding it to be unconstitutional, the judge has made a declaration that there is an obligation to consult and has given the province of British Columbia 18 months to set something up so that there can be meaningful consultation before people are out there, free miners are out there digging, looking for minerals, even if it's not on a commercial scale, they're just looking for things. Now, the other interesting element of it, and this may have much broader significance, is that the First Nations in this case were claiming that not only was this a violation of the constitutionally protected rights, their rights, they also claimed that there was a separate obligation under this Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. And it's pretty broad, right? When you read this thing and you read the attached UN declaration, all manner of things should be covered by this. Now, the judge, interestingly, found that, first of all, this was the very first case that anyone was aware of that interpreted, well, what does that mean? And the judge concluded that that act, the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act, first of all, does not implement that UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. And what that means is that when you have a some sort of like a foreign treaty or UN declaration, something of that sort, it doesn't really have any legal impact directly under domestic law, right? And the claim here by the First Nations was, well, now it does, because look at it's been attached in this Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. The judge rejected that and found that the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People Act did not implement that UN declaration in domestic law, didn't make it part of British Columbia law, and further found that the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act did not create justiciable rights. Like, you can't go to a judge and say, I want you to enforce section such and such of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. Instead, the judge found that that act was an interpretive aid when looking at existing legislation, and that when you carefully read what's set out in it, which begins with the fact that the talks about in section 2 of that act, the purposes of the act, talks about the way in which the government should take measures necessary to ensure the laws of British Columbia are consistent with the declaration, and so found that it is a direction and aspirational and a direction to the government in terms of what they ought to do, and in some cases might help interpret what a section of another piece of legislation ought to mean if that's ambiguous, but that act does not create standalone rights that you can go to court and say, look, you're not doing what the UN says should be done under article such and such. And that's very significant, because otherwise that act could have really broad implications in terms of what rights and obligations there are. Now, that's unlikely to be the final word on the matter, right? There, it's one of these cases that the printer was really working hard. It's a 118-page judgment.
Wow.
And it's the kind of judgment that is likely to wind up being appealed, right? These things, because there's, you know, so much at stake here. That's a likely outcome, but at least that's the legal word for the moment, is that act doesn't implement all those things. They are not legal rights you can go to court and insist upon. They are help for interpretation and their aspirations for government in terms of what they should be trying to accomplish. But that is a different thing from what was claimed in this case, and that's the first legal word on that, and I guess we'll wait and see how that plays out.
Michael Mulligan, we've got just over 3 minutes remaining on today's time.
Sure. The last case on the docket for today involves a application by special constables at the Legislative Assembly to unionize. There are a group of special constables. They are, I think, often retired police officers who would work at the legislature, and they would do things like provide security there, remove disruptive protests. They can even do things like ejecting a member from the chamber or from a committee where the speaker determines that they've been disruptive. So they provide security at the legislature. And that group of people wished to unionize. And so they made an application to do that. And the Labor Relations Board said that they could. that was contrary to claim by the Legislative Assembly, so really the current government, right? They have the majority there, who argued that permitting the unionization of these people would violate parliamentary privilege. Hmm. And the concept there is that parliamentary privilege requires a separation of powers between the legislative, executive, and judicial branches. So, for example, the legislature needs to carry out tasks such as acting as a check on executive power and enacting legislation. And if you could have some other branch of government preventing it from fulfilling those functions, it couldn't operate, right? You can think about how that might be, right? Hmm. And so that's a pretty important principle.
Yes.
And so the legislative assembly appealed by way of a judicial review the decision of the Labor Relations Board, arguing that no, parliamentary privilege should prevent this group of special constables from being able to unionize, because if they unionize, they might be able to, for example, go on strike. And if all the special constables are on strike, it might mean that the legislature couldn't function, right? If there's no security there, doesn't that just hold up an entire branch of government?
And yeah. How can that be? Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
So that's the argument. Now, there's a test for that from the Supreme Court of Canada, and really it boils down to a necessity test. Is this something that's so sort of core and necessary to the proper functioning of the legislative branch that privilege ought to prevent that kind of oversight by some other branch, potentially, of government? Hmm. And the judge here carefully considered that, but ultimately concluded that, well, parliamentary privilege is important, and it must prevent some other branch of government from, like, stopping the other one from working.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have a circumstance where it would immunize that, like the legislature, against ordinary laws and so forth, including in this case the right to unionize. And so the net result here was that the Legislative Assembly was unsuccessful on the judicial review, and the group of special constables does have the right to unionize, as the Labor Relations Board found, despite that concept of parliamentary privilege. So a very interesting case on a interesting topic. And all the other element that's, I must say, a bit of a head scratcher is there have been now a couple of recent examples. This one and ongoing legislation over the government trying to force government lawyers into a union they didn't want to belong to, where you have a circumstance with a Labour-backed NDP government in court now on the second case in recent memory, fighting against unionization efforts of government employees. So an interesting decision and a broader state of affairs. So that's what's happening at the legislature.
Michael Mulligan with Mulligan Defense Lawyers, legally speaking, during the second half of our second hour every Thursday. Michael, pleasure as always. Until next week.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
All right. You too. Take care.